Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akins, our guest this hour. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and it's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin. And boy, do we have a lot of weird questions. Jimmy deals with a lot of weird stuff over at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, too, and I believe I forgot to ask you about that. How's everything going at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Oh, the mysterious world continues to turn.
The mysteries continue.
Yeah, no shortage of them.
Now, I know there's no shortage of them, but how often do you find a new one where you go, oh, that might go on the list?
Oh, that happens, yeah, I don't know, pretty regularly. People send in suggestions, although most of the ones they suggest are already on the list.
Yeah.
And I run across ones myself in my own reading and research and think, oh, this would make a good episode. It just depends. But currently there's, I think, over 2,000 mysteries on the big list. And we've only gotten to a little under 300 of them so far.
Wow. Well, yeah, if you've got a list of 2,000, someone would have to really find something special for it not to have been on that list.
Yeah, at least of the kinds of mysteries that we do.
Yeah, yeah. You can find Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World at mysterious.fm. And this week is the second part, right, of a priest who helps stuck souls.
Yes. So last week I interviewed Father Nathan Castle of the Dominican Order about a ministry he has. He reports he gets dreams from people who died in various ways, and then he interprets these dreams as a call for help on the part of the soul as it's in its purgation process, as in its journey to God. And he and a prayer partner contact the soul and give it a kind of counseling, and they pray for the soul and help it move on in its journey to God. And so last week I interviewed him and we talked about what he does. And this week I go into analysis mode and from the usual perspectives of faith and reason and say, what could we discern about this based on reason? And what could we discern about it based on the teaching of the faith? In particular, since he contacts the spirits, what are the dynamics of talking to dead folks, you know, how does that work? Because a lot of people think, especially in the Protestant community, think you can just never talk to dead people. But that's not the Catholic perspective. Mm-hmm. And there's more flexibility here than a lot of people realize. And so I explore that question in depth, in just what is permitted here. And there's more that's permitted than you would think. It's not unlimited. There are limits, but there's a lot more than you'd think. So I talk about that, and that's today's episode, so that's already out. Next Friday is the fifth anniversary of the show. And for the fifth anniversary, I have learned over the years that many people in the audience have had mysterious experiences. And since I've been studying parapsychology, I've now been trained in how to analyze mysterious experiences. And so I said, let's do that for our fifth anniversary.
Oh, that's
We put out a couple of, and there have even been parapsychological studies of mysterious experiences. And I'm following in that tradition. We put out a couple of calls, just two, for people to send in their mysterious experiences. And even though we only asked for them twice, they sent in video and audio recordings where they're talking about their mysterious experiences, and just the ones where they wrote it in, you know, like by email. When I put them all in one document, it was 80 pages of single-spaced text.
Wow. This is a mysterious world.
Yeah, they had lots of mysterious experiences, so I selected some. I'm saving the rest for the future. Mm-hmm. But I selected some, and we present them in next Friday's episode, and then I offer commentary. I mean, with one exception, I didn't actually do an investigation of the experience, but just hearing the experience described, I can say, well, here's what category it would go into, and here's what you'd want to watch out for in terms of, could this have a natural cause? But if it has a non-natural cause, this is what it sounds like.
How cool. That's fun. Fifth anniversary. Wow. Congratulations on 5 years.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that, and at a pace of one a week, you're over two.
Little more than one a week.
A little more than one a week. All right. So you're coming up on 300, or where are you now?
Yeah, we're getting up to 300.
Wow.
We're at like 271 is next week's episode.
Hey, if you haven't listened to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, it's one of the most popular documentary podcasts on the internets, and you can just go to mysterious.fm and check it out. Or just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I've done it many times, and it does take you where you're going. Let's get a weird question for Jimmy. Here's a weird one. This is from an anonymous questioner. I'm a bit of a survivalist nut, and I'm always preparing for the collapse of civilization. What could give you the idea that this civilization would collapse? I can't imagine.
Maybe all the previous ones collapsed?
Yeah. Or the current condition of this one. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, if there was a nuclear war or really any kind of catastrophe that would trigger a societal collapse, and the chaos was so widespread that most of the bishops and all of the cardinals were killed, how would the new pope be elected? Could the surviving bishops, who I would imagine would be cardinals because most likely they'd be remote rural bishops, elect the new pope? Oh, would not be cardinals, I beg your pardon, because they would be remote rural bishops. Could they elect a new pope? Furthermore, what if the bishops were killed? Could regular priests somehow advance one of their own to the bishopric? If not, could they at least lay their hands on lay people and continue apostolic succession that way?
Okay, so first thing, there might be some cardinals that would, bishops who are cardinals that would survive. Pope Francis is concerned about the church being overly centralized in Europe and right. in the developed world. And he recently appointed a cardinal from Mongolia, which is rural and has almost no Catholics. So, but since we've specified in the scenario that all the cardinals are gone, what would happen? Well, we're dealing with a situation, to use a fancy Latin term for it, that is praeter legem. Praeter legem means apart from the law. It is something the law does not provide for. Because if you look at the church's current law regarding how you elect a pope, it needs to be the cardinals who do it. But so if you have a situation where there are no cardinals to do it, you're dealing with a situation that the law does not provide for and is therefore praeter legem. But you're not bound to the law if the law is impossible to fulfill. So if a law is impossible to fulfill, then you can do what you need to do under what's known in legal circles as a necessity defense. You know, like if the law, the speed limit in your town, let's say in a particular zone, is 30 miles an hour. But if you're in a car with someone who's having a heart attack, you can drive faster than 30 miles an hour to get them to the hospital. So you have what's known as a necessity defense. You're in a situation that the law does not provide for, and you're able to do what is necessary. And so the same thing would happen in this situation. Even though the way the law is currently written, it requires the College of Cardinals to elect a new pope, in an emergency situation where there's a necessity, we got to elect a new pope and there are no cardinals to do it, there would be solutions. Now, one solution that's possible would be the bishops who survive could appoint new cardinals. Even though now you have to be appointed by the pope, if there's no pope and you need cardinals, well, then the bishops could do it. Or the bishops could hold a council and elect one of their own. So they don't, they, and then the new pope could appoint new cardinals. But one way or another, it would be the bishops who would come up with the new pope, either directly through a meeting of, or, and it wouldn't have to be a physical meeting, it could be an online meeting. But they would be the ones to come up with the new pope, either through a meeting of all of the body of bishops or by designating some of them as cardinals or with some other term to be the ones to elect the new pope. So that's what would happen, assuming we have no cardinals but surviving bishops. What if all the bishops were killed? Well, the next thing that Anonymous asks is, could regular priests somehow advance one of their own to the episcopacy? And the answer is, maybe. One of the things that exists in Catholic tradition is there have been situations where priests had permission from the Pope to ordain someone else to the priesthood. And that would suggest that the power, now there, so you have, that has happened in some cases. It's happened, for example, in remote abbeys where the head of the, where the abbot who's the head of the abbey is a priest, and it's remote, and so there aren't any nearby bishops to ordain new priests in the abbey, and the abbot has gotten permission from the Pope to ordain one of his brothers a priest. And so that's happened in some circumstances, but it is not universally agreed upon that this is possible. So you have a diversity of opinion on this question. Based on historical practice, I would say this is an open question. Today, the ordination of men is reserved exclusively to bishops. But that hasn't been the case in all places in history. And so I would say there's two possible opinions here. Either these cases resulted in invalid ordinations and they just didn't realize they were going to be invalid, or these cases illustrate that it's possible for a priest to validly ordain. So if that's the case, then priests could come up with new priests and maybe bishops, because there's a question about how the office of the episcopacy developed. One of the things you find when you look in the New Testament is originally the terms for priest, and the Greek term there that's relevant in a Christian context is presbyteros. It means elder. And the office of bishop or episkopos, overseer, they're originally identical. The terms were used, both terms were used for the same office. And you can see that in St. Paul's pastoral epistles that were written in the AD 60s. And then by the beginning of the second century, so when you have Ignatius of Antioch writing around 108 AD, you have a differentiation that's occurred where now there's typically one person in a local church who is regarded as the episkopos, as the bishop, and he's got a group of presbyteroi or priests who report to him. And the question is, well, how did this transition occur? Now, it occurred at the end of the apostolic age, between the AD 60s and the AD 100s. And so, presumably, the apostles had, the surviving apostles had some role in this transition, but it's everywhere at the beginning of the second century. And one of the most common interpretations of what happened is that you originally had a body of presbyters who were also called overseers or bishops. That's what the term bishop means in Greek, of the congregation. And then because groups need leaders, you got a group of, you know, 5 or 10 guys who are all bishop, who are all presbyters. Well, they're going to need a leader. So one of them is going to end up as, he's like the guy who oversees our group. He's the president of our group. He's the chief priest and so forth. And that priest, because the term overseer, episkopos, sounds higher than the, you know, if you're overseeing, well, that's a higher sounding term than elder. And so the chief priest in every church became known as the overseer or the bishop. And that's a very plausible reconstruction of the transition that happened. It leaves open a question, though, of, so is a bishop just a priest with special faculties, or is there a sacramental difference? And this was an open question for a huge chunk of church history. In fact, I mean, you'll have church fathers and doctors of the church like St. Augustine saying, yeah, basically bishops are the same thing as priests. They just have greater jurisdiction. You know, they have more legal rights in what they can do. But sacramentally, there's no difference. Now, that issue got revisited very recently at the Second Vatican Council. And so at the Second Vatican Council, the Council Fathers chose for the first time to actually teach that there's some kind of sacramental difference between a bishop and a priest. The text, though, of what they say the fullness of the sacrament of orders is attained with the episcopacy. So that implies that priests don't have quite the fullness of it. But they phrase themselves in such a way at the council that I know theologians who say that you can read the text without it requiring a fundamental sacramental difference between bishop and priest. And so if all that's the case, if priests are capable of ordination based on various traditions, in various historical incidents in the past, and if the bishopric evolved out of the priesthood, and if there's not a fundamental radical difference between the two offices, then it could be possible for priests to come up with a new bishop and elevate one of their own number to the episcopacy. That's all speculation, though. None of what I just said is certain, but there is, in this weird scenario where all of the bishops get killed somehow, and I don't foresee that happening because it's, if the human race survives, it's going to contain some bishops. But even if all of the bishops were killed, there is a plausible scenario from that you can build from church history that would allow priests to come up with a new episcopacy that would be valid and thus able to continue apostolic succession and the sacraments and everything like that.
Anonymous, what a great question. Thanks very, very much. It fits the category of weird question perfectly, and we've got more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Conversations with Consequences, where we delve deeper into issues affecting our church, our country, and our core, the family.
As Catholics, we need to be informed, aware, and able to talk through some of the tough topics that we're facing in our culture and in our world. Conversations with Consequences gives us the tools to do so.
It's not enough to pray. We have to be a light for the world.
Conversations with Consequences, tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and it's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin on this Friday afternoon. And thanks again to everybody who helped us out over the last few days during our pledge drive. We don't have the final number, but I can tell you that the third day was an extraordinary day and one that really lifted spirits around here, and I just want to thank you for that. I know many people prayed for the success of our pledge drive, and many people contributed to the success financially of our pledge drive, and we're grateful for all of it, and just really grateful that there are so many people who are willing to be partners with us in this effort here at Catholic Answers. So next week we'll have better numbers, but we know we're in the ballpark. We just don't know exactly where we're going to land because we have to see what, certain checks and things come in later, and we'll see. But thank you again for your help and your support. Weird questions. People get to ask Jimmy all kinds of weird things, and we love it, and it's a lot of fun. And if you've got a weird question, if you think, I'd like to ask Jimmy a weird question, you can. Well, if you're in contact with Jimmy in one of his social media places, you might do it there. But an easy way to do it is just send it to radio@catholic.com, our website here in the radio department, and we'll make sure Jimmy gets it. radio@catholic.com. The next question for Jimmy comes from Martin, and Martin says, when the Magi came, do you think it made the Holy Family wealthy enough to travel and stay in Egypt, provide for a three-year ministry of 13-plus, and care for his beloved mother Mary until the Dormition?
No, I don't. We're told that the Magi gave three valuable gifts to the Holy Family, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and that would have improved their financial condition temporarily, but I think we have quite good evidence that it didn't make them rich because of two things. First, Jesus and his father Joseph were manual laborers, and they're both the word tekton is used to refer to them, and that's often translated carpenter. It can refer to other, not exactly what we think of as a carpenter. It can refer to that, but it can also refer to builders and other people who work with their hands. But so at least we can say they were both manual laborers while Jesus was growing up. Mm-hmm. And that means they were not rich aristocrats while Jesus was growing up. Also, Luke, and this is at the beginning of Luke chapter 8, he tells us that during the ministry of Christ, when he's going around in Galilee and preaching, a whole bunch of women traveled with them, and Luke names some of the women, and he says, and they ministered, it's going to be a little different in different translations, but it says that these women ministered to Jesus out of their substance, meaning they supported him with their money. And so he was actively receiving donations to support his ministry, his traveling ministry with the 12. And so he did not have lots of financial resources. Also, now that I think about it, there's a third reason to say Jesus wasn't wealthy, which is the band of the 12 kept all of its money in one bag that Judas was the keeper of. And so at least that would suggest that they again, with these other pieces of data, they weren't rich. And so I would say that even though the valuable gifts that the Magi gave did have an impact on the Holy Family's finances, it wasn't such that it set the Holy Family up for life as rich people. I would suspect that what happened to those gifts is they all got used during the sojourn in Egypt because they had to travel, they had to find new place to live, they had to undoubtedly bribe people because bribery was a standard part of the culture. They had to then travel back, and we don't have any indication that they were rich while Jesus was growing up. So my theory would be that those gifts, or at least the bulk of them, were used up by the trip to Egypt and back. They may have had a little more, but it didn't last till Jesus's adulthood.
Martin, thank you. Thanks very much for that question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. And Joe has this one. Are the laws of logic and thought, identity, non-contradiction, and excluded middle, true of all possible universes or only of ours? Would multiverse theories or alternate dimensions modify these rules? And do the laws certainly apply even here, or could one argue that maybe an extreme form of scotistic haseity versus
hexaity.
Okay, I always have trouble with that one. Versus quiddity mean that maybe they don't.
Okay, so you will find some Catholic sources that talk about laws of logic and thought, and that discussion is useful, but I tend to come at it from a somewhat different perspective, from a more philosophical perspective. One of the things that this kind of categorization tends to be, one characteristic of this kind of categorization is that it's based on older scholarship. You'll find it going back quite a ways, and it has the authors who use this categorization scheme tend not to be up on modern developments in logic. Now, there are things like the law of non-contradiction and the law of the excluded middle and so forth that you will find in logic, but you'll find a lot more than that. And you also typically won't find academic philosophers outside of some very narrow Catholic circles discussing laws of thought. I would want to know more about, so exactly how are we conceptualizing this? Because I won't go too far down that road, but I think that this is a somewhat simplistic categorization system. And so if Joe is interested in reading about this, I would suggest he read more broadly. You know, check out some recent work that has been done on logic and metaphysics, and not simply what is found in older Catholic philosophical works or older Catholic apologetics works, because there's a lot more on this. Having said all that, I think that if something is genuinely a law of logic, it's going to apply to all universes, because God's omnipotence is the ability to do anything that is logically possible. And therefore, the laws of logic are related to God's ability to create stuff. And since God creates worlds, every world is going to obey the same set of laws of logic. However, there may be things about the laws of logic we haven't yet noticed. And so there may be different applications of them in different universes that could be surprising to us.
Right back with more Weird Questions. Are you ready to defend your faith in a world of unbelief? Join us at the 9th Annual Catholic Answers Apologetics Conference. This year's theme, I Believe in God. And it'll help you provide clear and charitable answers to atheism, agnosticism, and plain old indifference. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us in San Diego from September 21st through 24th as we welcome our special guest, Dr. Scott Hahn, and an all-star lineup of great Catholic speakers. Spend quality time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and enjoy 4 days of fun, fellowship, and adoration of the Almighty. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register. Enter promo code EARLY and save $50. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're having a good Friday afternoon here, taking weird questions and getting Jimmy's answers to the weird questions. I hope you're having a good Friday afternoon. This one comes from Andy. Andy, this is a weird question. Thank you very much for it. Why is most lunch meat round when bread is mostly square?
Okay, so we need to talk about the origin. And, you know, this is a fair question. This is weird questions, not weird religious questions. And I answer non-religious questions on other shows, so this is just one of them. And it is weird that most lunch meat is round and most bread is square. So why is that? Well, first we should talk about the origins of the components of a sandwich. You know, if you have most lunch meat is essentially, it's a version of sausage, you know, and sausages, whether it's salami or bologna or, you know, liverwurst or whatever it is, it's kind of sausage. Now the bread that sandwiches are made out of also, it does not go back hugely far in history. If you were to go back to the time of Jesus, you would have bread, but it wouldn't look anything like our modern square bread.
Oh, right,
It would be flat bread. And you might have some little round loaves like pitas, but you wouldn't have the modern sort of rectangular loaf that we have today and that we then cut up to make slices of bread. So why do these two different things have, and I should mention, sandwiches don't go back all that far in history. They're actually credited to a gentleman named John Montagu, who was an Englishman, and he was an earl in England. He was a nobleman, and he was the fourth earl of Sandwich. And that's why sandwiches are called sandwiches, because they were allegedly created by the fourth Earl of Sandwich. And allegedly, he created them because he, like a lot of people in this time, a lot of rich people in this time, was big into gambling. And so he would be playing cards, and he wouldn't want to quit the game to have a seven-course meal. So what he would do instead is just tell his servants, you know, cut up some sausage and stick it between pieces of bread so I'll keep my fingers clean and I'll eat that. And that's how we got sandwiches, at least according to the story. So why are sausages round? Why, which tells us why most lunch meat is round. It's because of the way they made it. Sausage is made out of the innards of out of the flesh of an animal and sometimes other parts of an animal, and they would grind it up. And so you'd have this ground up animal flesh and other stuff. And then they would need to, but it's just a goop at this point. You need something to give it a shape. And they didn't want to waste parts of animals. And so back in the day, I mean, even today, you can find whole hog sausages where they basically grind up the whole body, maybe minus the bones, but it's everything else that gets ground up. They also say, don't ask how the sausage is made, but I need to explain at least part of that in order to answer this question. So what do they use to give the sausage, the ground up meat, a shape to turn it into a sausage? The answer is they used intestines, because after they had slaughtered the animal, they had all these parts of the animal they needed to use, and one of those parts was the intestines. And so what they would do is they would take the ground up sausage material and shove it into an intestine. They, of course, cleaned the intestine first, but then they would shove it into the intestine and use the intestine as a casing. And then they would seal off both ends, and both ends would be pointed where they had sealed it and also kind of wrinkled, which is why you see wrinkling on the ends of some sausages if you see an uncut sausage. And I don't know that these days they're not all necessarily intestinal casings, but this is how it started. Well, intestines are tubes. And what happens if you then slice a tube to make luncheon meat out of it, you end up with a circle or a basically circular shape. So that's why luncheon meat is round for the most part, because historically, I mean, it is a form of sausage, and historically sausages were made with round intestinal casings. What about bread? Well, in bread, you've got something similar. You know, you grind up wheat and you add water and maybe other things like eggs and milk and stuff to it, and you end up with a goop, which we call dough. And you can, you know, roll out the dough so it's flat and make flatbread. But if you don't want flatbread, you're going to need a container to put it in. Well, I guess you could put the bread goop, the dough, into an intestine, but I don't think that would survive the baking process well. It would be better if you had a container that was made out of metal or ceramic. And because metal and ceramic, it survive intense heat better. And so what would happen is they would make containers to put the bread goop in, the dough in, that were made of metal or ceramics. And because the most efficient space-filling shape is a square or a rectangle, they made rectangular bread pans. Because you can stack those up and put them in your cabinet, and it uses the dough efficiently. It makes a good shape because you can set your rectangular loaf of bread down on a table for purposes of slicing it. And when you slice a rectangle, you get a square. And so that's why bread tends to be square, or at least modern bread tends to be square. Incidentally, as I mentioned on the show before, Originally, you had to do your own bread slicing. But in 1928, something very special happened. New technology allowed bakers to pre-slice the bread for you so that you would buy a package. Instead of just buying a loaf of bread that you had to cut up yourself, you could buy a package that had a loaf in it that was pre-sliced. So all those housewives didn't have to cut the bread manually anymore. Sliced bread was the latest, greatest thing. And that's why we have the expression, the greatest thing since sliced bread, which was introduced in 1928. They tried to ban it during World War II because they said this is a luxury we can live without. Not according to all the housewives who previously had to slice bread. And the effort to ban sliced bread during wartime failed because having the pre-sliced bread was so useful for housewives. So that's the basic story on why most lunch meat is round and why most bread is square. It's because most lunch meat is sausage, and sausage was historically made using intestines as casings, and intestines are round. And because bread today is made using bread pans of metal or ceramic, and they're made rectangular because the rectangle is the best space-filling shape, and therefore it's a good shape to put your bread dough in.
Andy, thank you very much for that question. That fits right in with weird questions for Jimmy Akin. The next one is from Zane. Jimmy, huge fan of your work, your terminal intellect and towering beard. And then he says, maybe I got that backwards. If we in the eschaton are given our infallible bodies and the New Jerusalem in essence becomes our planet Krypton, can you postulate on what we will do in the eschaton? Saints are generals in God's army, etc. But what will our missions be? Will we go and evangelize the universe of fallen creatures? If so, will Christ have to incarnate on that world to save them? Or will we, as we have been made gods, or is that a blasphemous thing? If we do hypothetically have to incarnate for them, would our infallible bodies change to the alien form we incarnate for? Thus, we become aliens only until we go to the next world. Or if Christ can do the incarnating saving, would be or are there already millions of incarnations of Christ in his form in heaven, adjusted to whatever creatures he's interacting with?
Okay, so I'm not entirely sure what Zane means by the new Earth being our planet Krypton, because Krypton blew up, and God's not going to blow up our new home. He may mean it's our planet Krypton in the sense of we will effectively have superpowers once we're in our glorified bodies. And that's true. We will have superpowers once we're in our glorified bodies because Jesus had superpowers in his glorified body, and we're told we're going to be like Jesus. In terms of what we're going to be doing, well, we are told we're going to rule and reign with Christ, and that involves activity, but we don't know what our missions are going to be. They may involve just living life here on the new renovated Earth. We may not go out into the cosmos, although we may. And if we do, we may or may not encounter life forms that need evangelizing. If we do encounter life forms that need evangelizing, then we could certainly tell them what God did for us. There would then be a question of, well, how does that apply to them? And that's something I've devoted a whole episode of Mysterious World to. Mm-hmm. It's episode 55, so you can find it by going to mysterious.fm/55 for more information on that. But basically, if we evangelize them, well, we might or might not appear in their forms. We would presumably be able to change our own forms to look like them if we chose, given our glorified bodies, and we might choose to appear in their forms to evangelize. It's kind of like the Jesuits. When the Jesuits evangelized China originally, they didn't continue to dress as Europeans because European clothing looked weird and foreign to Chinese people. So the mm-hmm. Jesuits would wear Chinese clothes to fit in better and get a better hearing for the gospel among the Chinese people they were talking to. And in the same way, if we were evangelizing, you know, people from another race in space, we might take on their form to do that. Could we redeem them somehow ourselves? According to St. Thomas Aquinas, the answer would be, or the principles that St. Thomas Aquinas articulates, the answer would depend on God's choice, because God, according to St. Thomas Aquinas, and St. Anselm disagrees with this, but according to St. Thomas Aquinas, God could have redeemed us in any way he chose. And if that's true, if Aquinas is right about that, and I tend to agree with Aquinas on this, then God could choose to let one of us redeem them. Do I think God is likely to choose that? No. I don't think God is likely to choose us as redeemers, even in our glorified form. I think it would be more likely for the Son, or even one of the other persons of the Holy Trinity, to redeem them, possibly the same way he redeemed us, by dying a sacrificial death. The concept of sacrifice is very deep in human nature, and it could well be very deep in the natures of other creatures too, which would make it a fitting means for redemption for them, because they would understand the concept of sacrifice, which is essentially a form of gift giving, just like we understand gift giving and sacrifice. When you give someone a gift, you've just sacrificed it to them. You don't have that thing anymore. You gave it away. And so since we understand that, I think it's likely other rational creatures would have gift-giving and sacrifice customs that would be appropriate for God to use to communicate the message of his love and redemption to them. Could Christ incarnate into these other species? Well, as we covered earlier today, according to Aquinas, yes, and I agree with Aquinas on this one. If God can incarnate, if the Son in particular can incarnate as a human, then there is no logical contradiction in the idea of incarnation. And if there's no logical contradiction in the idea of incarnation, meaning God can do it by his omnipotence, there's no logical contradiction in the idea of incarnating twice, or three times, or a billion times. And so I would agree with Aquinas, the Son could incarnate as many times as he chooses in as many different natures as he chooses, and so could the Father and the Holy Spirit, because they're all omnipotent, so they can do what they choose as long as it doesn't involve a logical contradiction, and none of this does. Now, would he have to do those things? No. He could say, hey, I already did it once, and I paid an infinite price on that cross in Jerusalem on earth, and that paid for the whole universe. And so we could just evangelize them and baptize them, and they would be ordinary Christians like us. Or, if he chose, he could incarnate on multiple planets or do something else to provide for their salvation or not, because this is a free act on God's part. And there could be, you know, multiple other incarnations of God up in heaven that we simply have not been told about. That's up to God.
Hey, that's another very fine question. Thank you very much, Zane, for that. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more of these weird questions we've got for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
If it's central to the faith, you can find it on EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of EWTN Radio, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free. The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central. It's like podcast heaven. Visit EWTN.com/radio/podcasts today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. There's the weird music for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. That's what we're doing this afternoon. We're glad you're here with us. Got a few more weird questions we can get to before we have to finish this hour. And this one comes from Chris. Jimmy, Chris wants to know, why did humans take so long to be advanced just recently with agriculture, medicine, economy, infrastructure, etc.? What were they doing for 200,000 years?
They were trying to survive, and surviving wasn't easy in a pre-technological environment. As a result, that's what they were doing most of the time. They were living hand to mouth, and they didn't have they had so much of their time devoted to just trying to survive that they didn't have a lot of other time for research that would help them develop technology. Nobody had the idea of technology at the time, and so they weren't working toward it. They were just, well, this is how we live, this is how you hunt a bison, or this is how you hunt a mammoth, and these are the kind of plants that are local that are safe to eat, and we're going to roam around our territory as hunter-gatherers and collect food and eat it. And that's all they were trying to do. They weren't working towards a goal of how can we improve the world, because mm-hmm. they're concerned about their own family and their own family's survival, and that's about it. So that's part of it. Now, there are other parts of why they didn't progress faster as well. One of them is there has been a change in the level of human intellect. Humans navigate a very complex culture. A lot of times, it's been noted, you know, let me put it this way. When an organism encounters a difficulty, it puts pressure on certain genes that will, and this is known as selection pressure, that will cause those genes to replicate in a population. And if the genes do not have selection pressure on them, they will tend to degrade and disappear from the population. So, for example, let's suppose you're a lion and your ability to survive involves having sharp teeth and sharp claws. Well, that's going to put selection pressure on the teeth and claw genes that will encourage sharpness. And so lions that have sharp teeth and sharp claws will survive. Lions that have duller teeth and duller claws will not survive as much. And so, as a result, the sharp teeth, sharp claw genes will come to predominate in lion society because lions depend on their teeth and claws a lot. Well, humans don't have sharp teeth and sharp claws. So what do we depend on? Primarily our intellects. We also depend on other things like thumbs and tongues, you know, which allow us to communicate. But essentially, we survive based on our intellect because we're not the most fearsome, fastest creatures ever. And so we evolved to be the smartest. And intelligence is our survival strategy. And so that puts selection pressure on our intelligence genes. Now, various things can do that, you know, the need to find food, the need to hunt animals, the need to fend off other groups of humans that are our opponents. So warfare puts selection pressure on genes, on our intelligence genes. And we have an incredibly complex social society. And people who navigate that society cleverly will tend to survive and reproduce better. And so that's going to, again, the complexity of human society is going to put more selection pressure on our intelligence genes. And so over a period of tens of thousands of years, you're going to have smarter and smarter people because of the selection pressure of navigating human society and surviving and reproducing. So we're probably considerably smarter than our ancestors were. There's also evidence that we're more cooperative than our ancestors were. And that's why we've been able to grow bigger societies. If we had the same intelligence genes as our ancestors of 50,000 years ago, and if we had the same cantankerousness of our ancestors of 50,000 years ago, we wouldn't be able to build big technological societies. We would be in little small tribes, just because we're not very cooperative, trying to survive and just caring about our tribe. But as the level of cooperativeness goes up, you survive better and you reproduce better if you can cooperate with more people. And so today we have bigger societies, and there are advantages to all of that. One of the things that happened about 5,000 years ago, it's a little more than 5,000, is we developed writing. And this is a third major factor besides survival and intelligence. This is a third, and cooperativeness. This is another major factor in why we developed technology, is we developed writing. Because before you had writing, all knowledge had to be passed on from person to person. So if you wanted to learn what someone else knew, you had to go talk to that person. And you had to get it all in real time. So if someone has a lifetime of learning, they're never going to be able to pass that on to you because they're going to die before they do. But if they can write it down, they can preserve that knowledge and it can live on after them. And you can read it at your convenience and it can be spread to other people. So not everybody has to go to this person while they're still alive to get what they know. And that ability to record and store knowledge allowed the development of technology. Because you're not dependent on tribal lore anymore. You can keep permanent records. You don't have to keep reinventing things. When you find something that works, you can write it down. And that'll preserve it permanently as long as the record lasts. So between us developing certain basic forms of technology like agriculture that allowed us to survive more easily, and the selection pressure on our intelligence genes and our cooperativeness genes allowed us to build bigger, more complex societies, and the development of writing allowed us to preserve and improve knowledge over time. All of that reached critical mass. And you can put the critical mass point at a number of different places in history, but all of them are recent. It's that accumulation of things that allowed technology to really start taking off. And depending on what level of advancement of technology you want to talk about, that could be, you know, the Neolithic Revolution or the invention of writing or the invention of philosophy shortly before Christ, or the invention of the Scientific Revolution or the Industrial Age. But it's this accumulation of things that allowed rapid and accelerating technological advancement. So before we had modern intelligence, modern cooperativeness, writing, and some basic modern survival things, survival was hard, and that's just what they were working to do for a long time.
Thank you very much, Chris. Jimmy, do you want to take another question?
We can do the next one.
All right. Mallcat asks, with admission by the USA of UFOs, what do we think about extraterrestrial beings, souls, evangelizing, origin, etc.?
Well, we don't have an opinion on these. Different people have different opinions. The church has no teaching here. The church has no problem if intelligent aliens exist, or if intelligent aliens are visiting us. They would be other children of God that he created elsewhere. They might be naughty or nice, but they would be fundamentally other children of God. And in terms of them having souls, they would have souls because the soul is what makes you alive. In terms of evangelizing them, that would depend on whether they are fallen and need evangelizing, or whether they want to be, or whether they would benefit from being evangelized, even if they're not fallen. I have, as we mentioned earlier, a whole episode of Mysterious World on this. It's episode 55. So just go to mysterious.fm/55 and you can hear all about it.
Chris and Mallcat, thank you very, very much for those questions. Lots more questions. If you want to get in on the fun, if you've got a weird question for Jimmy Akin, if you've got something you'd like to hear the faith and reason perspective on that Jimmy brings, just send us an email with your question to radio@catholic.com.
And flag it as a weird question so we know which bucket to put it in.
Yep, and we'll put it in Jimmy's bucket. And also, if you like this stuff, you should really check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where coming up on 300 episodes after 5 years of mysteries over there, lots of mysteries for you to enjoy. You can find that at mysterious.fm. One last thing. Don't forget the $10 book sale over at shop.catholic.com this weekend. 35 different titles are on sale for $10 each at shop.catholic.com. That'll do it for us. Jimmy, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure, as always.
I really enjoyed the weirdness today. And that'll do it. As I said, we'll see you next time, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.